Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. 15 hours ago, interactive TV player GenVid landed $113 million in new funding and a former key Netflix executive as a new advisor. What will both developments make possible? Learn when GenVid Chief Executive Jacob Novick and new advisor Cindy Holland join me next in an internet radio exclusive. We've got another new Disney Plus scripted affair in our second half hour. Turner & Hooch adapts the popular Tom Hanks and Dog film as an ongoing series. You'll hear more from creator and executive producer Matt Nix in another internet radio exclusive. Also ahead, Pluto TV pushes original series, more Tunes of Thrones, and my early best and worst primetime Emmy nominations. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, simulcasting live from New York on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, and TuneIn Radio, and present on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Verbal, and the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. This just in, tomorrow will be televised, brought to you by Audible.com, the leading provider of spoken audio entertainment information that will transform the way you hear the world. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book or two when you sign up for a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/televised. More details later in our program. Welcome, wherever you are, to the third of our three episodes this week of the program about TV's current and future, and we got a big one for you today. Some super people coming your way in the next hour, and we invite you to interact with them. All it takes, a phone call from you. So pick up the phone and dial in at 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number is good anyway you're catching us across the country or around the globe here on Blog Talk Radio, Speaker Tuner Radio. Shy about the phone, no problem. We got a chat room for you. It's SimonApple04 by name. You'll find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. While the promo is on the air, you can connect others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon, your Blog Talk speaker, tune in screen, follow the instructions, and other people can be live with you. 94 degrees at the top of the hour here in New York. Yes, heat advisory is in effect here in the Big Apple until about 7, 8 o'clock tonight. And our guest from GenVid will join us live here in the Big Apple after these news notes. The next frontier for Pluto TV, original series. That declaration came early this afternoon from a Viacom CBS senior executive involved in the company's multi-channel bundle. Look for originals to premiere soon, Amy Kester exclaimed during a virtual panel session hosted by Variety, the showbiz bible. A few of these first-run programs may then get a second run on Paramount+. Kushner also provided new details on Pluto's conversion of RidePass, a subscription venture for professional bull riding, into an ad-supported channel. The switch will come July 20th, that's next Tuesday, accompanied by a multi-million dollar marketing campaign and outreach at upcoming PBR events. Remember our recent newswire on HBO working up an animated Game of Thrones series? We'll make that three. One of the pair getting development now will cover the Golden Empire of Yai Tai, an advanced society not present in the original game series, of course, written by George R.R. Martin. Now some news notes. VH1 will launch My True Crime Story August 2nd. 8 unscripted episodes are on tap. Tacoma PD begins its third true TV season on September 16th. For the second year in a row, a Yellowstone episode from creator Taylor Sheridan has won the Western Heritage Award for fictional drama on television. Several South American soccer leagues have finalized a multi-year contract for games on Prende TV, that's Universal's Univision's mega content venture. And finally, Peacock's unscripted companion to its recently launched series Dr. Death, based on the famous podcast, will premiere on July 29th. And that is news notes for today. If you've been a regular listener to this program, you know that around the last year or so, we've been covering Rival Peak. It's considered the first virtual world on television interactive project running on Facebook Watch, available on most smart TV sets and smart devices, as well as Facebook's own smart TV product, Portal TV. The idea is this. You get the chance through your voice or through remote control to interact with virtual characters in different environments, sort of like Survivor. And every week, you get the chance to eliminate one of those characters with a special program. Well, as time went on, the program did better, the watching did better, and it really caught on with a lot of national attention. We've had the head of GenVid on this program twice over that time period. It started last fall and then continued until this spring. Well, as you heard in the tag, this past Thursday, 15 hours ago, GenVid, the people behind Rival Peak, picked up $113 million additional funding. And on top of that, they have got one of the leading program executives of recent years to join them in an advisory role. Well, we have both of those people on with us right now. Joining us live here in New York, the chief executive officer of GenVid, back for his third time on this program, Jacob Novick. Jacob, welcome in.
Hi, thank you. Great to be here.
And And joining us also in New York, and I believe this may be one of her first interviews on radio or television since leaving Netflix at the end of 2020, the former head of original content there, Cindy Holland. Cindy, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Happy to be here, Simon. Thanks.
You're welcome. So, Jacob, with that $113 million, how is that going to propel GenVid and your work in interactive TV?
When we started working on Rival Peak, we were really just a technology company that wasn't prepared to produce or publish this kind of interactive content. We were tools, and we still provide those, and we build those, and we've got a massive number of engineers working on those tools for media companies and developers and game publishers. But, you know, we started to see an opportunity where we could also help create these things and not just provide the tools. And Facebook, when we worked on Rival Peak, asked us to actually publish that game, to oversee its entire development of the interactive TV show. But as mentioned, we weren't prepared to do so. And to create that kind of publishing entity, to be able to shepherd production, whether it is in narrative, in development of the game itself, in thinking about UI, UX, the creative and future monetization and sponsorship opportunities, you need a different group of people. And so the raise that we did recently allows us to create GenVid Entertainment, the first publishing organization dedicated toward this new format of interactive media that we call MILES, or Massive Live Events. We're hiring creative directors, we're hiring production people, producers, UI UX designers, we're building an account system, we're going to be managing all the data that we get from it, et cetera, to really kind of pioneer this area. And of course, everything that we build, every technology that we create goes back into our software and allows any developer out there to create their own form of Rival Peak too.
And how would a mile work? How long would it run for? How would viewers be able to control what they see?
So the core concept of a mile is that it's both massive, which is to say lots of people are interacting together, and live, that it's happening at the time at which you are watching it. This differentiates itself from other forms of content where you may be watching something that was pre-produced and are therefore kind of mostly going and choosing branching paths. And also differentiates itself from video games, which are really about you playing and your journey or your match in a game of Fortnite, rather than a million of people kind of working together to do so. And so those are the kind of core components of a mile that differentiate it in my head from other forms of interactive media. We also really put a lot of emphasis on story and the community shaping that story, which is one of the reasons that working with Cindy was so important for me. As we think about narrative, as we think about how we start to tell truly interactive stories, we want to create places, moments, events that allow for a community of people to actually feel stakes, feel agency in that creation as to where they can appear. Facebook is a great partner of ours, and we're looking forward to future projects. We're also an interactive streaming technology provider, and our software does work on Twitch, YouTube, Facebook, as well as proprietary platforms, as well as even places like Huya, which is Tencent's streaming platform in China.
Mm-hmm. Cindy, of all the things you could be doing in your post-Netflix life, why did you decide to be an advisor on this?
Well, most of my career has been spent pursuing the intersection of entertainment and technology, and I'm really excited about what Jacob and the GenVid team are doing, and I'm happy to lend a hand. You know, this is a new form of storytelling that they're creating, so there's a lot to figure out in advance, how you plan pre-production, how you write stories while reacting to the community-driven choices that are made, tools to support them, how to plan production differently, what in-event activities are used to supplement the main story, and the list goes on and on. I think GenVid's really at the forefront of truly interactive, community-driven stories. It's the ultimate water cooler conversation, actually, because it's happening now, and you play a role in shaping the story. You know, it's the kind of thing that I could only dream of when I was playing Myst by myself on a PC in 1993. So it's really exciting.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard from some of the people you work with at Netflix or some of the series creators at Netflix or elsewhere about your role as an advisor? I mean, is Shonda Rhimes or Ryan Murphy or some of the other people you've dealt with, or the creators of Orange the New Black, Jenji Kohan, whatever, have they given you a call and said, hey, this is a very interesting thing you're dealing with. You know, I want in on this.
Well, the news just broke yesterday, but I certainly have heard from a lot of folks who are excited about this development in the ecosystem and what it could mean for storytelling and for creators in the future.
We are speaking with the two key people behind the GenVid development that broke 15 hours ago yesterday. The head of GenVid, Jacob Navick, chief executive, and former Netflix vice president Cindy Holland, who's come aboard as advisor. And they're both with us live in this Internet Radio exclusive half hour from the Big Apple right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. SoundHab, I'm with you live from New York, 94 degrees at the top of the hour. Yes, we are under a heat advisory. So, by the way, if you're in the area and you're listening to us, please take it easy. Drink plenty of fluid. The advisory is supposed to let up, by the way, around 7, 8 o'clock tonight. And we want to hear from you. What do you think about this development and its impact on television and interactive TV? Give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Next week, we're going to be with you Monday and Thursday, rather than our normal Monday-Friday time period at this very hour. And we don't know yet who will be coming on Monday, but I can tell you on Thursday, and we're doing it Thursday because yours truly, a week from today, is going to be heading down to Baltimore with my family to celebrate my sister's daughter's marriage to somebody very, very special, and that is just fantastic. But I can tell you on Thursday, we have a very special lead guest, the composer of Seinfeld, Jonathan Wolf, will join us. If you haven't heard, at long last, a soundtrack of his music from that classic series has now been released. And we will have Jonathan on to talk about Seinfeld and the rest of his TV career, which he has brought to a close. Plus, we hope to offer the soundtrack as a classic trivia segment prize, either next week or the week after. Jonathan Wolf from Seinfeld. He'll be with us as our lead guest. That's next Thursday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here exclusively on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Jacob, what's the sense you're getting coming off both of these deals, having Cindy on board and also getting this funding?
I think being able to bring somebody as talented and experienced as Cindy is very exciting for us. It shows that, you know, we're starting to be at a place where we're not just talking about what that vision is, but actually able to execute on it and bring people who have a lot of experience in that execution into not just our production slate, but also in working with many of the creative talent that we are bringing on board for these products. And I'm actually really, really excited for, you know, being able to showcase, hopefully announce in coming months, what intellectual properties we're going to be able to be working with, which creators, both from Hollywood and from the game space, we're going to be using. And in addition, you know, when it comes to the ability for the company to properly manage and build and produce this, the sheer level of talent that we're going to be able to bring on, because we are doing something very new. There are almost no people in the world today with experience building Miles. There are very few people who have thought about it from a design perspective or from a data perspective. And we have to build out a lot of those systems, those design Bibles from scratch. So on the one hand, it's, you know, incredibly exciting. On the other hand, really, you know, the hard work starts now.
Mm-hmm. Cindy, where do you think we are at in this world of interactive television? It seems at this juncture, Netflix, of course, had Bandersnatch, had Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, the special. Both of them were nominated for Emmy Awards. You vs. Wild, the series, which did well. Some animated episodes. But now we have Food Network Kitchen. We have Peloton, which is now available on the TV set in many areas. Some other exercise situations, too. Samsung is doing interactive fitness, maybe interactive lifestyle services. And now this, where do you see the big picture here? And how fast do you see from here, given this situation, the big picture of interactivity unfold?
Well, I think we're very, very early days. If it were a baseball game, it'd probably be maybe top of the second inning at most. But I think this is a really rapidly evolving ecosystem in technology and entertainment, and the scale with which you can host and produce and have a lot of people engaging in a story and working together to decide what happens next in the story, and having, you know, systems that are able to respond on the fly. I mean, it's going to really accelerate quickly from here, and you know, maybe we're at the very bottom of the S-curve.
Mm-hmm. It's really very, by the way, of course, we had the announcement earlier this week about Netflix, the possibility that they've just hired an Electronic Arts and Facebook person to head what may be a game service similar to, or individual games similar to what Apple is doing with Apple Arcade, what Google's doing with Stadia, where you might be able to not only play games on your television set alongside watching your favorite Netflix shows, but also Netflix may be able to develop new television series and merchandising out of that. By the way, I'm curious, what did you think about that that deal, that news?
Well, I have a lot
If you don't mind me, no, go ahead, then.
No, please.
You know, there are two big challenges here that they kind of have to overcome, right? One is the fact that a lot of these products require local device and hardware access that, you know, wouldn't be on your Roku that you're normally watching Netflix on, right? And separate from that, the interfaces by which you touch it, like remote control. So these are hard issues to solve for games. But I apologize for interrupting. Go ahead, Tim.
No, I was just going to go down the very similar path as Jacob. You know, I have loved Netflix. I spent 18 years there. I have a lot of colleagues, former colleagues who are, you know, friends, and I have a lot of respect for them, but they are trying to solve fundamentally different challenge, or at least certainly in the early exploration of interactive with Banner Snatch, you know, there was a desire for that to be playable on the broadest set of Netflix ready devices. So the navigation had to be pretty simple, to Jacob's point. It was a first step toward interactive storytelling. And, you know, it's a bunch of smart folks there, and I'm sure that they will be evolving and iterating pretty rapidly.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, it seems that two other developments are going on. One is we're seeing more and more of these smart TV sets and devices have artificial intelligence built in, Alexa, Siri, Google Assistant, et cetera, where rather than use a separate device to control things, you just – because it's incorporated into the TV set or the TV device, whether it's a stick or an add-on or a plug-in, you just can say, Alexa, show me this. And so you can control what you watch and how you use television with your voice as well as your remote control. The other thing is 5G. The Warner Media Innovation Lab here in New York did a special event that AT&T, its current parent company, sponsored. And you get the sense, and we had, by the way, a Verizon person on our show nearly two years ago, that suggested that 5G may have a role to play in interactivity. I'm curious what you both think about that, both artificial intelligence and 5G, in terms of the ability to make the process much easier.
So I'm happy to jump in with my thought, but also very happy to go after you, Cindy. You let me know.
No, please, Jacob.
So, you know, we have two different kind of threads here when it comes to the future of technology. One is when it comes to televisions, what are the platforms by which you are riding on? And so if you look at televisions that have smart software embedded into it, most of them are capable of running basic interactivity as well as the majority of streaming elements to it. But they are a mechanism for effectively delivery of content that, interestingly enough, right now is becoming kind of weaponized in the same way as carriage deals used to be weaponized. So you see that in all of the problems that Roku has, where they, you know, will drop YouTube or engage in other business excursions with multiple apps if they don't like the deal terms that they're getting from. And so even though it looks and feels like it's a technology thing, it actually becomes a very interesting business conundrum for a lot of the content providers in the space. I think that there is significant opportunity to utilize voice when it comes to the way in which you engage with content. We've certainly integrated some of that into our products where you can say, you know, hey, Alexa, I want to vote for this or make that decision in the story, and we can actually take that input in. And I think we're at the earliest days of how that works and looks, but they are connected to back-end platforms, whether it's Amazon's, whether it's Roku's, or whether it's others, that it's going to be very interesting to see how those technology decisions affect and impact business practices. With regard to 5G, my biggest hopes here are on the ability for us to deliver low latency interactivity in a wide swath of locations. Unfortunately, I don't think that 5G has quite lived up to its promises due to a number of difficult technical hurdles. But if in the next decade those get resolved, you're going to start seeing the ability to play and manipulate worlds that look like visions in the metaverse regardless of where you're located. One thing to keep in mind is the best promises of 5G really are just as good as your bandwidth in your home. And so it's not as though you don't have that internet connectivity today. The difference is having that internet connectivity portable can change the way you interact with the world. And we've seen that in, you know, 4G enabling everything from Pokemon Go to you creating TikToks anywhere you go. So it's my thought, but passing the baton over to Cindy, please, would love to hear from you.
I don't think I can add anything more eloquent than that on this topic. You're more the technical expert.
Well, Cindy, as the new person in play here, what do you see as the first priority in terms of advising GenVid on where it goes from here?
Well, I think it bring a lot of experience and insight into the interests of early adopter, mainstream, and global audiences. I have a lot of experience of working with creators and producers and actually, you know, helping to get content made. So I think those two pieces also in, you know, working with the team on the slate that they're building now and identifying additional opportunities for looking at great IP around the world that might be perfect for mile exploration.
Mm-hmm. This is an area where, you know,
GenVid, our Withers this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. They are both here with me in New York. We want to hear from you in our mini moments with them. So give us a call, 646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. A week from Monday, one of our guests here on Tomorrow We Televise will be one of our faves from CNetNews.com, digital and senior reporter Joan Salzman. We'll talk to her. By the way, she wrote a very good story about Netflix's move into gaming that's available on News.com right now. It was published yesterday. We'll talk to her about that story, get her thoughts about where we are at in this whole world of smart TV sets, device and programming services as we hit the second half of 2021 and more. So Joan Salzman will be with us a week from Monday, and 2 weeks from Monday, this very program will begin its 15th year on the air, and I hope next week we can tell you about some of the guests that we would love to have on. So be sure to tune in 2 weeks from Monday as Tomorrow Be Televised begins its 15th year of existence. Jacob, in addition to Cindy, you have some other heavy hitters that are also involved as advisors. Who are they, and how will all of them get together in the near future?
So in addition, the advising team features Matthew Ball, who I think is a pretty well-known analyst and speaker in this space and on the metaverse, as well as Anna Sweet, who's a good longtime friend of mine, the CEO of Bad Robot Games, and Yoichi Wada, the longtime CEO of Square Enix, my former boss and mentor, who basically built that Final Fantasy Maker from just being a few hundred-person company into a 10,000-person behemoth. And in every faction and area of the business, you know, we deeply rely on this bench of extremely talented and experienced people to help with us. So what I was going to say a few minutes ago, you know, the production experience, the story experience is not something that we have internally at GenVid today. It's something that we have been missing, and one of the reasons we're very grateful to have Cindy involved. If you look at what Wada-san has brought for us, that understanding of game publishing and production is second to none. And similarly, when it comes to our industry's business development as well as connections and network, what Anna has based on her background, both being the head of Steam and then afterwards the head of development relations for Oculus is truly important to everything that we do and where we plan to go as a business.
Mm-hmm. And where do we go? What is the timeline? I had a chance to see yesterday the video clip that you now have on your website. We'll talk about whether you can find that clip in a moment. But what is the timeline in terms of coming up with a project and bringing it to viewers?
Sure. So, you know, in game development, you usually think of things in terms of years. At my former employer, Square Enix, we could work on a Final Fantasy title from 5, 7, even 10 years. But the industry moves very fast, and the future is going to be here even faster than we can imagine. So most of the productions that we work on have a pre-production time of a couple of months, and we try to release after the end of pre-production within about 12 to 14 months, depending on the ambitions of the content. I'm a very strong believer that we treat these products as live service games do, which is to say you release something and then based off of the audience feedback, you integrate and you change and you amend. And you may recall me discussing this when we spoke about the conclusion to Rival Peak. We launched it as effectively an open beta with no marketing put toward it. And based off of the initial user feedback, we added a lot more interactivity, interactive maps, puzzles, match three, tributes, possession, crafting, etc. And we managed to do that all within the span of that initial season. So these future, you know, elements of content, what you see in Project Raven, which we showcased as what the next generation of gendered content looks like yesterday, are us continuing to evolve based off of the real-time user feedback and provide experiences that will always push the envelope, but do so not in a extended period of development time, releasing as fast as we can while still hitting that quality bar.
Mm-hmm. And Cindy, along with your work advising Jacob and his organization, what else are you working on? Anything you can talk about right now?
Nothing to share right now. And, you know, been trying to, in part, just to, detox a little from Netflix and enjoy my best life as best as you can during this pandemic. So I'm looking forward to, you know, working with Jacob and the GenVid team and to, you know, getting out there and appreciating life, as I think we all are trying to do.
Well, if you want to know more about GenVid and how this $113 million in new funding and all this advising is going to be paying off, here's where you go online, www.genvidtech.com. It's www.genvid, G-E-N-V-I-D, tech, all one phrase, .com. And check out this new 2-minute sort of prototype of what the next Rival Peak may be. I think you will find it quite fascinating. What I loved about it is that it is multi-platform. It is the television set. It is the smartphone. It is the tablet. You can interact from any device, and that's a good thing in terms of growing this whole interactive TV medium. Jacob Navick, Cindy Holland, thank you both very, very much for coming on. Cindy, it's great to finally have you on this program at last. All the best to you in this role and whatever further you do in television. And Jacob, thanks again for being with us. I have a hunch that this is your second time around this year. We will probably have you back when it looks like before the end of the year, your next GenVid under this new funding is going to happen.
Looking forward to it. Thank you. And thank you for joining us too, Cindy.
Thank you.
It is a pleasure. Jacob and Cindy, take care. Have a wonderful weekend.
You too. Bye-bye.
Jacob Navick and Cindy Holland joining me live here in New York. More Tomorrow Be Televised coming your way, but first some words from the fine folks at Audible.com. You want to catch up on Harry Potter? A lot of great books by that author, J.K. Rowling. A lot of great adventures. Well, here's a way you can do it. Check out Harry Potter on Audible as part of a one-month trial. It could be your book to check out for 30 days. When you try a trial with Audible.com. You know, Audible.com is the leading provider of spoken digital entertainment information and inspiration. Over 200,000 titles to choose from, and you listen on any device, whatever you're hearing us on right now, at Blog Talk Radio, Speaker, TuneIn Radio, etc. Just sign up at audibletrial.com/televised. You get one free audio book, health and wellness information while supplied lasts, a one-month trial of the service, and great customer service from Audible's parent, Amazon.com. And if you're an Amazon Prime member, you're in even better luck. You get two audiobooks to choose from for your trial of one. One of them can come from the growing catalog of Audible Originals. We're talking original audio productions and podcasts, best of Broadway, off-Broadway, and regional theater, and great one-woman and one-man performances. So how about making this time of the year a great time to check out Audible.com and hear how it can transform the way you hear the world or someone you love. It makes a great gift any time of the year. For all the details, it's audibletrial.com/televised. The person that put Burn Notice on the map on USA, then The Good Guys and The Gift on Fox, he's back with his latest creation, Tournament Hooch, premiering next Wednesday on Disney+. Matt Nix joins me next from Los Angeles. Plus, of all the Primetime Emmy nominations that were announced earlier this week, what's my early pick for the best and the worst individual nomination? That, too. All of that after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. This is the best internet radio on the planet, www.blogtalkradio, speaker, and TuneIn Radio. Together, reach over 60 million listeners around the world every month and growing. Tonight at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Central, Sports Beat Radio. Lots to talk about. Second round of the British Open or the Open Championship. NBA Finals. Return of the baseball season. WNBA. Soccer. All sorts of great stuff. Sports Beat Radio tonight, 6:30 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific, right here on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, best of BTR 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to the second half hour of Tomorrow Be Televised on this Friday afternoon. Third of three episodes we're doing this week. Simon Abbott with you live from New York. If you have a question or comment from our next guest, ring it in, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Our next guest today put Burn Notice on the map for a great run on USA Network, then followed up with The Good Guys and then The Gifted on Fox. His latest creation, which also serves as executive producer, premieres this coming Wednesday on Disney Plus. It's Turner and Hooch, the series adaptation of a very popular movie starring Tom Hanks paired with, what else, a dog. Joining us live from Los Angeles in an inner radio exclusive, Matt Nix. Matt, it is great to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
It is a pleasure. I believe you had an opportunity to hear the first half hour. What's your takeaway from what you heard from Jacob and Cindy?
Well, I mean, I think it's super interesting. It's with any new venture like that, with any new form of storytelling, you know, it's always waiting for someone to, you know, revolutionize it, for someone to sort of explore the boundaries of that kind of storytelling. And it's going to be really interesting to see who does that and who breaks through with that kind of storytelling, because it's really a new thing. I mean, it's kind of halfway between a video game and a TV show, and you know, it's it needs its great creator or its great creators, and it'll be interesting to see who those are.
When you, by the way, are with your fellow series creators and executives, does the subject of interactive TV come up? Or does it come up less than when Netflix, for example, had Bandersnatch and won the Emmy Award for that, or won the 2 years ago, or last year when Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, that interactive special and final episode of that popular series got nominated for an Emmy? Is there about the same amount of buzz? Is it bigger? Is it smaller? What's your sense about the interest level?
Well, I mean, I think it's no accident that in those two cases, you had established shows that had dedicated followings and basically a producing team behind the show that had the clout to say, hey, we really want to do something new and interesting and different. Also, I think the audiences for those two shows were kind of primed for something unusual and interesting. And I think that that's not necessarily true of every kind of show. I mean, I don't think people don't sit down to watch an episode of Law and Order thinking to themselves, wow, I wish I could, you know, interact with this, or, you know, there's nothing. But what you want out of that kind of TV show is to sit down and enjoy yourself and eat your dinner and, or, you know, have it on while you're doing the dishes or whatever it is. And so I think it's a pretty specific thing that you're looking for, I think, if you want to do that kind of television. So, yeah, I mean, it comes up, but I think everybody's conscious of the fact that when you're trying to get a TV show on the air, you're trying to convince a lot of, you know, major media companies. Usually it's like at least a couple of major media companies to devote an enormous amount of money to making something, and to say, oh, and in addition to that, I'd also like to make a really significant technology spend for something that is not proven. And that is just that's a daunting prospect. And so I think you see it mostly when, you know, it's the kind, I don't know that they did this specifically, but it's the kind of thing that Lost would have discussed in its fifth year, where, okay, now everybody's interested in this kind of thing, and this is the kind of show that it's appropriate for and stuff like that. It's pretty hard to do as a show creator at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. So how did Turner and Hooch come your way?
Well, I've been under a deal at 20th Television for many years, and so in the merger between 20th Television and Disney, suddenly there was this whole world of stuff that was available to show creators. And And at one point, I was just asked by the executives, hey, have you ever, you know, were you a fan of Turner and Hooch? And that was coming out basically right as I was graduating from high school. And so I was like, yes, of course. And they asked me if I thought it could be a good TV series. And I took another look at it, and I said, yeah, I think it could. And so I kicked around some ideas with them, and they liked them, and that's we went forward with it.
Now, take us to the thought process behind it, because after seeing the trailer, it sounded like there are two basic ways you could go with one in adapting this for a series. One is to, you know, pretty much adapt the movie as it was presented, mm-hmm. the big hit that it was, and see where the story goes from here or expand upon what was in the movie. The other was sort of, and this is the one you've taken, which is Next Generation. You know, rather than focus on the characters in the movie, focus on the son of the character Tom Hanks played, or the offshoot breed of the dog kind of thing. How long did it take before you decided this is the direction I want to go?
For me, it was pretty much immediate. I mean, I think that, Tom Hanks is Tom Hanks, right? Tom Hanks, he's not just any actor. He's like the actor. Of his generation in a lot of ways. And basically when I went in, I basically said to the executives, here are the two things that would be really important to me if we're going to do this. And the first I said was, I don't want to make a show where we're saying to an audience of people that enjoyed the original movie, hey, you know, here's someone who's trying to fill Tom Hanks's shoes. I don't think it's not fair to an actor who, you know, because if you think about it, some people are going to be expecting an impression of Tom Hanks, which is not really sustainable. And, you know, no one's going to do it as well as Tom Hanks did it. And some people, and if you don't do an impression of Tom Hanks, then, well, what is that, right? It's the Tom Hanks story without Tom Hanks. And so basically, I just didn't think that left a lot of room for original storytelling. And as I said, I didn't think it was fair to whoever we got as the lead actor, who would need to create a new character and find his own way through. And so I said, I think it's important to do something that respects and honors the original film. And I think the way we can best do that is by telling the story of this character's son. And I talked them through why I thought that could work. I mean, you know, in the movie, it's a story about a guy who discovers, he's solving a crime, but through that, he falls in love with this dog and it changes his life. And, you know, so it seemed reasonable to me that somebody who had that experience might want that experience for his son. And also that somebody who had become a small town hero and cracked this enormous case in the little town of Cypress Beach, that a son of someone like that might feel, you know, an obligation or a desire to you know, follow in his father's footsteps and come out of his father's shadow. And I thought that was an interesting story to tell as well. And so I just landed on the idea of the Tom Hanks character has passed away in the series and has left a dog to his son because he feels that this is what his son needs and that it's going to do for his son what it did for him. And, you know, ultimately, you know, obviously the best thing would be, you know, if Tom Hanks is like, sure, I'd love to do a television series, you know, like play the fourth lead in a television series, but that's not going to happen. So this felt like the best way to honor the original film and really respect the characters that people love from the movie without, you know, sort of falling into needing to do an impression of Tom Hanks or remake a film, you know. And then the other thing I'd say is the film itself is a really fun film. It's not a particularly – the dog's role in the film, he's basically a clue in a murder, which is interesting and it's super fun, but he's not – really a partner to the Tom Hanks character. And to do a TV series, you really need a dog that is in some way participating in the solving of the crimes on a week-to-week basis. And so that was another change that I thought needed to be made.
Turner and Hooch, the television series, premieres next Wednesday on Disney Plus. That's July 21st. And right now we've got the creator executive producer of the series, Matt Nix, which is live from Los Angeles here on Tomorrow Be Televised. Sam, I'm with you live from New York. Delighted to have you on this Friday afternoon. If a question or a comment for Matt, don't be shy. Make that call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04, my name. In case you didn't hear the first half hour, coming up on our program on a special edition next Thursday, not Monday, Friday next week, it's Monday, Thursday, our special lead guest will be the composer of Seinfeld and many, many more television series, Jonathan Wolff. And if you haven't heard, finally, at long last, after decades, there is a soundtrack from Seinfeld now available. We'll have him talk about the soundtrack associated with music. We hope to also offer that soundtrack as a prize for our upcoming Classic Trivia segment. Oh, speaking of the Classic Trivia segment, we'll have that for you on next Monday's show, 3 p.m. Eastern Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Be Televised. Again, next Thursday, our lead guest, Jonathan Wolff from Seinfeld, Internet Radio exclusive. Matt, how long did it take before you got your lead actor, played by Josh Peck, who, by the way, when I saw the trailer, there's a lot about him that reminds me of how Tom Hanks or Peter Scolari was on Bosom Buddies.
Yeah, you know, the thing about it is he has this very winning quality and this kind of underdoggy feeling. He's I adore Josh as a person and as an actor. And how long did it take to find him? 10 seconds. It was literally like, the casting folks, our casting director, Eric Schulier, and the folks at the studio in casting there, kind of the minute it was greenlit, they said, we think you should meet this guy, Josh Peck. And I said, Josh Peck? And I wasn't really familiar with Drake and Josh. I'd seen a little bit of it, and, I have kids who were very aware of it. But I said, okay, well, I'm happy to meet him. And I just walked in. We had lunch. And, a couple minutes in, I was like, well, I guess this is the guy. Terrific. And that makes my life easy. I don't have to do a bunch of auditions. And so, we just talked about his vision of how he wanted to do it and how we like to work together. And we were totally on the same page. It was sort of a love fest from the jump.
It seems, Matt, you're contributing to the comeback of Nickelodeon stars, Josh of Drake and Josh, iCarly, who just got renewed for a second season on Paramount Plus, with Miranda Cosgrove and her crew. I'm curious how Josh, now as a young adult, was able to mesh in not only with the rest of your cast. You got some really good people on, like Lindsay Fonseca, and you've also got Reginald Johnson from the movie, reprising his role. But how about dealing with not one, not two, not three, not four, but five of these dogs or mastiffs, if you will. An actor like Josh, not to mention the rest of the cast, deal with all of these animals?
It's funny, like the sort of two questions together, the Netflix question, or sorry, not Netflix, the Nickelodeon question. It's actually kind of related to the dog question, which is one of the great things about the kind of training, if you can call it. I mean, it's not exactly training, but the people coming out of that world is they don't have a lot of time. They don't have a lot of money, and they have to produce on a tight schedule. And everybody understands what they're there to do, right? So if you're a kid actor on one of those shows, you need to make the moment work. And also, stuff's going to happen, like you're going to have slime dumped on your head, or you're going to be in ridiculous situations, and you really have to make it work. And one of the things that I saw with Josh, he came in and tested, actually, we brought in a Great Dane just so that we could see kind of how he did with a dog. And it was pretty incredible, I have to say. Like, he did the same scene twice with a dog. And in the first version of the scene, literally the same scene, it's just him and a dog, this Great Dane, who's, incredibly large, comes up to him and is face-to-face with him, almost nose-to-nose, looking straight into his eyes, right? And Josh does the scene with the Great Dane that way. And he kills it. It's great. It's super funny. Everybody loves it, right? And then I say, okay, well, let's try it one more time. We're taping it. We've got a little time here. Let's do it one more time. And this time, it's the same scene, only the dog lay down on the ground and went to sleep and looked up at him one time during the audition performance, I mean, during the test. And Josh made that work too. And it was the opposite performance from this, you know, creature that is essentially his co-star. And he managed to make both of them work. And that kind of flexibility is something that you get when you spent your childhood, you know, reacting to every situation that comes up and, you know, wrestling with your co-stars and needing to get everything done as quickly as possible because your hours are limited because you're a kid and all of those things. That's super important training for something as unpredictable as working with a dog. And the thing about the Mastiffs is they're great. I just got a French Mastiff puppy myself, and they're lovely dogs. They're incredibly loyal and really gentle and sweet. But they're also not movie dogs. I mean, there's a reason you don't see them on screen a whole lot because, you know, German Shepherds, they really want to please, or Golden Retrievers, they, you know, they'll do anything for a treat. And Mastiffs are sort of like, yeah, no, it's cool. I'm good. You know, I can take your treat or leave it. You know, or when they're done for the day, they're like, yeah, no, I'm going to sleep. No, I really, you can call me all you want. I'm just going to lie here. And so, you know, that's a challenge. And so, you know, we had a number that we could sort of swap in and they were all great, but, you know, you never really knew what you were going to get because if the one dog that was super energetic, was, you know, wasn't feeling it that day or, you know, was hot or, you know, whatever. And we took super good care of the dogs. We wanted to make sure they were safe and happy at all times. So if one of the dogs got tired, he was done. And so we'd bring the other dog, but the other dog had a completely different personality. And so for all of the actors, they really had to adjust and, you know, basically react to whatever was in front of them. And they did a great job. But it was really interesting just watching it as a challenge to an actor. You know, I know this sounds weird, but one of the things that really sank in over the course of the show was that dogs really are their own creatures. I mean, they are not humans at all. They do not understand English, no matter how much you want them to. If it's late at night and you got to get the scene done, you can't sit down with the dog and say like you can with an actor and say, "Hey, man, just I know you're tired. Can you just give me one, and then we'll be done." The dog's not going to understand that, right? So you got to figure out a way to do it. And that means that sometimes you have to do a scene with a dog that's not doing what you want him to do. But ultimately, some really fun things can come out of that as well, and some really great improvisation. And some of our favorite scenes were when the dogs were just being crazy, and everybody just rolled with it. And Josh was amazing at that.
Matt, thanks for bringing that up, because it's the same issue that people who produce nature documentaries have to deal with day after day, which is you can't direct Mother Nature. You know, mm-hmm. Mother Nature, Father Nature, and nature period is going to do what it wants to do, and just have to make sure your cameras are there when you got to roll. One thing, though, that in this last year dealing with the pandemic, we haven't talked a lot about. We talked a lot about how the pandemic is impacting actors, impacting production crews, but when you're doing a program that deals with animals and actors, how did the pandemic, I'm assuming that this was produced in the wake of the pandemic, wherever mm-hmm. you did it, how did that impact the ability to work with the animals?
Well, you know, one thing that you don't actually see, people don't really think about this when you're watching a show that has a dog in it, but it actually, well, starting off during the pandemic, obviously crowding is an issue. You want to have as few people as possible on set, as few people as possible in a scene. And the other thing is dogs are responding to people's faces. They're responding to where you look. They're responding to how you sound. They're responding to your mouth, your expression, the whole thing. And dogs don't really love masks, right? I mean, that's not a, you know, to a dog, that's like, okay, why is everybody covering their faces? Like, is this threatening? What's going on? And so it's a little confusing to the dogs. So the other thing that we had to deal with, and we were in Vancouver, was you don't really think about is, if you see a dog in a scene, there's a couple trainers, sometimes as many as four or five trainers in that scene who are there to kind of help draw the eye line of the dog. And so while the scene's going on, oftentimes the actors will be talking, but there's a trainer off screen saying, over here, right here, oh, look, 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 or they've got a slide whistle, or they're doing stuff to make the dog kind of look in the right direction or have the right behavior. And so that can double or triple the number of people in a scene. And of course, mm-hmm. you know, we're working very hard to keep everybody safe, and we're testing everybody every couple days and everything, but it's always an issue when you have to think about, oh, how many people are in the scene? Oh, it's just two people. Oh no, it's seven people, because actually we got to account for all the trainers, you know, for two different dogs and stuff like that. So yeah, it was a challenge. And then, you know, as I say, we had to, when people are in the scene, ideally, you know, they're not masked on screen, obviously. And then the trainers too have to sometimes really be super expressive with the dogs if they have to be masked for whatever reason. So it was a unique challenge that nobody had ever really dealt with before. So it was super interesting.
Huh. Matt, we'll complete on this note. What's it been like for you to create, write, executive produce a family-oriented show as opposed to a tongue-in-cheek genre show like Burn Notice the USA, or more recently, a genre, you know, fantasy sci-fi show like The Gifted?
You know, it's been a joy. I mean, really, it's I came into it really – I mean, let me back up and just say Burn Notice was certainly a tongue-in-cheek genre show, but at the same time, one of the things that the feedback that I got over and over from people was that it was a show that the family watched together. And people would say, like, oh, my grandmother loves the show and she watches it with my teenage son. And it always surprised me, but it was definitely a huge part of our audience. And I think that a big part of that was that show was really focused on people that cared about each other. You know, it got a little darker in the later seasons, but especially at the beginning, it was really focused on being, you know, fun and having big action and being entertaining and not taking itself too seriously. And that was really valuable coming into Turner and Hooch because, you know, I mean, here's the thing. It's a fun show. It's a big, fun, entertaining show. It is not a documentary. You know, like sometimes I want to say to people, like, yeah, no, actually dogs are not allowed to behave this way in the U.S. Marshals. I'm aware of that. Like, this is a comedy. It's a big action comedy. And it's aimed at being a fun show for people to watch together. And so, you know, Burn Notice was a great experience. It was super fun to do. It was also not a documentary. You know, you're not actually allowed to blow up that many things in the middle of Miami without having, you know, the FBI descend on the city in force and arrest everyone in town. So I had some experience with making things that were big and fun and entertaining and didn't take themselves too seriously, and that's what we did with Turner and Hooch.
And you can see the results starting this coming Wednesday, July 21st, on Disney Plus. Turner and Hooch, the series. And don't forget, Disney Plus available on most smart TV sets and smart devices. And by the way, congrats again to Disney Plus for 71 Emmy nominations in the primetime categories, including 24 for The Mandalorian and 23 for WandaVision. Again, Disney Plus available on most smart TV sets and smart TV devices. More details about the service and the program online, go to www.disneyplus, that's P-O-L-U-S spelled out, disneyplus.com. Turner and Hooch begins Wednesday, July 21st. Matt Nix, thank you again for joining us. A pleasure to finally have you on the program. Congrats on getting the show off the ground. You, cast and crew, hopefully Wednesday's the beginning of a great long run.
Fingers crossed. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome, Matt. Take care. Enjoy the Super Weekend.
Thanks.
Matt Nix, joining us live from Los Angeles. Well, as I mentioned a moment ago, Primetime Emmy Awards came out earlier this week. Lots of shows got in. Lots of shows got snubbed. In case you didn't hear the results, in terms of individual plumbing services, Netflix was the leader. Yes, individual plumbing services, not getting into the by platform or by, you know, organization. Netflix, tops among individual plumbing services, 129 nominations, HBO 94, Disney Plus 71. And then in terms of individual series, The Crown on Netflix tied with The Mandalorian from Disney Plus with 24 piece, WandaVision 23, and Hulu's The Handmaid's Tale 21. Well, I thought it might be nice to take a moment to give you my thoughts about what I thought was the best of the Emmy nominations and the worst Emmy nomination, one of each. And remember, these are early picks. Who knows? Could be, I haven't checked all the nominations yet, but I'll try in the coming months. Anyway, my picks so far for the best Emmy nomination, Primal on Adult Swim for Outstanding Animated Program. Once again, Gennady Tartakovsky shows that he is the Orson Welles of TV animation, and he really respects the audience. That's why he's so good. He's willing to go the max for the audience because he knows that he will get respect from the audience for doing it. And when you have a program like Primal taking place in primal times with no dialogue, only natural sound, often silence, and music, the result is quite spectacular. Happy it got the nomination. I think it might have a chance to win. A big, usually not unusual one for Adult Swim. And by the way, the second season of Primal is coming out either late this year or 2022. My pick for the worst nomination, no contest, the 2021 Academy Awards on ABC for Outstanding Variety Special. I'd love to be a fly on the wall and find out who the heck voted for this and what was the rationale. Because, frankly, there was no rationale for allowing what was a debacle of an award show, maybe the worst show in of its kind in the history of television, to go on the air, a show that barely got 10 million viewers, an all-time low record, and botched everything about that award show, maybe to the point of losing its audience for good. Why that got nominated for an Outstanding Variety Special, I'll never know. Enough said. So there you have it, my early picks for Best and Worst Emmy nomination of the Primetime Awards, which, by the way, Primetime Emmy Awards are coming out on CBS in mid-September, hosted by Sergey Attainer. Love to hear from you. What's your thoughts for those comments? What do you think got great nominations? What got snubbed? Email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com, or find me on social media. Anyway, that's it for today's show. Thanks to all of our guests. Thanks to all of you for tuning in. We'll be back on Monday at a regular time, and again, coming your way on Thursday at our regular time, Jonathan Wolf, the composer of Seinfeld. Also coming up on Monday, our new classic trivia question of the week and a brand new prize along with it. If you came in late on today's program, want to catch up on episodes you missed, go to that homepage anytime this weekend, blogtalkradio.com / televised. Check out our podcast. They're available 24/7 at iTunes, at iHeartRadio Podcast Network, Apple Podcasts, Verbal, Apple TV, as well as the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. And don't forget to check out our brand new website, and that is Tomorrow Will Be Televised. podsite.io. Tomorrow Be Televised. podsite.io. Recent episode at the top of the screen. Other episodes at the bottom. And you can also leave a comment as well. Love to hear from you. Email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. Find me on Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Whatever you hear, we do respond with it within 24 hours. Why? Because what you say matters now more than ever. The views expressed here are those of the participants, not necessarily those of Block Talk Radio and other distributors of this program. Andy Toews, Block Talk Radio General Manager, with Jay Sonnenberg, Head of Content. Website service provided by Podsite, the new internet avenue for podcasts. For more details, go to podsite.io. Our web coordinator, Gintaris Patris. Lobby Televised, brought to you by Audible.com and Amazon Division. Remember, Audible will transform the way you hear the world. For a one-month trial, 1 or 2 free audiobooks and more, audibletrial.com/televised. For Lobby Televised, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for listening. If you're in a heat wave area, please take it easy and safe. Have a great, great weekend wherever you are. Back on Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, you know where, Blog Talk Radio, Speaker, TuneIn Radio, our various podcast sites, including the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. Whatever you're up to this weekend and beyond, please make it safe. Make it great. We are living this pandemic now and forever. Until the next time, stay well and stay tuned.